The only purpose for his life could be to serve as a warning to others. It's the Drew Marshall Show.
There's a pale horse coming, and I'm gonna ride in. I'll rise in the morning, my fate decided.
Up next, Damian Echols, a former Death Row inmate and member of the West Memphis Three. At the age of 18, Damian and two other teenagers were wrongfully convicted of murdering 3 8-year-old boys. They would become known as the West Memphis Three. Echols received a death sentence and spent almost 18 years on death row until he was released just in 2011. It's not too long ago. West Memphis 3 had been the subject of Paradise Lost, a three-part documentary series produced by HBO, and West of Memphis, a documentary produced by Peter Jackson and Fran Walsh. Damian is the author of a New York Times bestseller called Life and Death memoir, and Yours for Eternity, which he co-wrote with his wife, Laurie Davis. Echols is an artist and has had two sold-out shows at Sacred Gallery in New York City. And in March, coming up, 2016, he has an upcoming show with the art collective The Hand in L.A. Damon is hanging out in New York these days, and he joins us on the phone right now. The guy has been interviewed by Piers Morgan even twice. Is it twice you've been on Piers Morgan? Can you remember all this stuff, Damon?
You know what? They all run together after a while. There was a time whenever I was on the road for almost two straight years because you know, the documentary West of Memphis came out, and then my book came out right after that. So for two straight years, I was doing, living on the road and doing interviews nonstop. There were times when, it's not an exaggeration, I was literally doing up to 20 interviews a day.
Wow.
So it all kind of runs together after a while, and it becomes one big glob.
Well, welcome to more of the glob.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, the last time I spoke with Peter Gilmore, do you know who that is, by the way?
I've heard that name.
Peter Gilmore is the high priest of the Church of Satan.
Okay.
He's been on the show a couple times. Very interesting guy. He and I have had some great conversations. But anyway, we were talking about Aleister Crowley. And I heard you say in one interview that one of the reasons that you were convicted of participating in the killing of these three boys was because you were a fan of Aleister Crowley. Really? Right?
Absolutely. That, I mean, you wouldn't believe some of the stuff they used as evidence when we were at the trial. They actually used Metallica albums showing the cover art. The fact that me and the other two guys that were convicted, we owned T-shirts that had, like, Iron Maiden and Slayer on them. They used pictures from skateboard magazines that we had hanging on our walls. And they said that these things prove that not only were we guilty of murder, but that we had no souls.
Man, where did you grow up? Mayberry?
Maybe even a little worse. I mean, at least the people in Mayberry were kind of friendly. I came from a small town in Arkansas called West Memphis. Even to this day, you know, if you wanted something like sushi or something there, you'd be out of luck. There's just nothing there. It's basically a giant truck stop.
Yeah.
If you weren't like a hardcore, extreme, right-wing, fundamentalist Christian, then you were automatically suspect.
Wow.
You know, if you were a Hindu or a Buddhist or anything like that, then you would be seen as a freak, much less when you get into the even more fringe spiritual practices, you know, things like Wicca, witchcraft, ceremonial magic, all of that.
Yeah.
You were considered downright demonic if you were a participant in any of those things.
Well, I've got to start off, well, I've already started, but I need to just say this right now. I need to actually apologize to you for something that really has nothing to do with you, but has to do with a state of mindset that I was in many years ago when I was... This is just embarrassing to admit, man, but dude, I took the whole satanic panic thing literally and bought into it hook, line, and sinker. And, you know, when guys like Mike Warnke, who was this supposed, you know, ex-Satanist who became a Christian, was going around getting paid to do the speaking circuit, and now we found out years later he was full of garbage. He was full of fecal matter, as you say on Christian radio. I'm so angry at myself because statistically, realistically, anecdotally, situationally, it was just garbage. It was called satanic panic for a reason. and I used your name. Check this out. I used your name. I didn't know this until we booked you on the show and I started doing research. I used your name in a message that I used to talk to teenagers about in regards to Satan and Satanists and evil, and gave you as an example of what happens when you listen to Iron Maiden. Dude, I was one of those idiots.
You know, it was one of those things where at the time, I don't think it's anything to apologize for, just because at the time, everybody was swept up there. You know, you had giant mainstream media sources like Oprah Winfrey and Geraldo Rivera doing shows about this, telling people, you know, not saying it may be happening, there's rumors it's happening. They were saying it is happening. You had people reporting that tens of thousands of people were being sacrificed by Satanists every year.
Yep.
You had people who, the guy who testified during my trial, who the judge declared was an expert in cult behavior, in satanic cult activity and all this sorts of thing. We came to find out later that he had never actually even stepped foot on a school campus, that basically he sent in, I don't know, 3 Fruit Loop box tops and got back a degree, saying that he is now a actual expert in satanic activity. And he was going around from police station to police station teaching the police what to look for and how to identify Satanists and all this sorts of things. Now we see in hindsight the guy was just crazy. Mm. But back then, everybody swallowed it hook, line, and sinker.
Well, lesson be learned. Anything that Geraldo believes, maybe take a second look at. I think that's really what we're learning here. Okay, so, you know, look, and I don't want to get into the stuff you get interviewed about all the time. I'm interested in some other things in your life, but let's just summarize stuff here. So you were the weirdo in the small town, the small Bible believing, you know, Bible Belt fundamentalist town. You know, you probably had the gothic look. You had the Iron Maiden T-shirt. You know, you had a bit of an attitude. Now, there was some, according to some things that I read, you tell me if they're true or not, there was some was there some mental health stuff going down in your life at the time, or was it just because you were a teen? Look, every 17-year-old, 16-year-old boy has mental health problems as far as I'm concerned, but I don't know. Was it bigger than that?
No, that's pretty much what it was. It was that combined with the fact that, you know, the satanic panic stuff you were talking about earlier was rampant in West Memphis at the time.
Yeah.
So I had been harassed by the police for probably about 2 years before they even arrested me for these murders. And that was a lot of what contributed to it. You know, I actually had, like, the head of the little occult expert for the police department. He was the one that led the charge to have me sent to a mental institution not once but twice. You know, the second time I was there, the doctor even said to me, she was like, "Why? I don't understand why you're even here." Hmm. And I said, "Well, that makes two of us." And that's what it all came down to. It was this feeding frenzy of wanting to find some sort of cult activity by the police.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I can relate a little, like, not a whole lot, obviously, but a little bit to that, because when I was about 15, I tried to kill myself, and as a result of that, you have to go to the mental ward for 2 weeks mandatory if you want any sort of free health care in the future. If you refuse that, then they say, well, tough luck. So I went, and I remember while I was there feeling like I wasn't part of everything, like I shouldn't be there, and I had 2 shrinks on the ward say you shouldn't be here. So I know what you're talking about in that sense anyway. So let's go to the prison thing, and you know, I want to talk about this 9 years in solitary. Can you help us understand the logistics of solitary? Because here's what I understand: 23 hours you're in a cell. You're supposed to, by law, be let out 1 hour every day. And I heard you say in an interview that 1 hour every day you get taken out of your cell, but then you get put in another cell. True story?
Exactly, exactly. I didn't actually see outside for almost a decade. You know, it was one of the things that contributed to destroying my eyesight. I didn't see sunlight. I didn't have fresh air, anything like that, for almost a solid decade. You know, that's one of the things that they released to the public. The American public, well, the public of the world usually has no idea what's going on inside the prison system. The only thing you know is what the prison system itself is releasing to the public. Yeah. You know, just for example, you may have massive riots going on inside a prison at any given time, and it's never going to be reported on the local media. You're never going to hear that on TV, because they feel that if they report on things like that, it would make the prisoners feel like they have some sort of power.
Yeah.
So almost nothing that goes on in prison is ever going to be known by the outside world. It's never going to be questioned. Most people accept whatever they're told. So they tell people things, for example, like what you just said, I'm in my cell 23 hours a day, allowed out of my cell 1 hour a day. So people think I'm outside, walking in the grass, breathing the fresh air, getting sunlight. None of that was true. I was in a cell 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for almost a solid decade. The only thing is, for that 1 hour a day, they would take me out of my cell and put me in another cell.
Anything else about the logistics of solitary that you think needs to be shared because we really don't get it?
Well, I think it's one of those things that people, when it comes to prison, most people have like this us versus them sort of mentality. And the thing is, most people who go to prison will one day get out. You know, the number of people who are executed by the state or who spend the rest of their life in prison is a tiny, tiny amount of the prison population. Almost everyone in prison will one day get out. They'll be back in your churches, back in your schools, they'll live in your neighborhoods. So it's probably not the best idea to drive them stark raving mad with solitary confinement and torture before bringing them back out into society.
Yeah, but dude, you were on death row. You weren't coming out.
Exactly. Once again, that's what they thought. So when I did come out, I came out with extreme post-traumatic stress disorder, all sorts of issues and problems because, you know, I'd been in prison for almost 20 years. I'd been in solitary confinement for almost 10. So I came out of that situation devastated. You know, I can barely remember the first year I was out of prison. The first year I was out, I can remember a few hours. I had to have someone with me at all times to help me take care of myself. I would have dinner with someone and then reintroduce myself to them as if I had never even met them, just because I'd been so shattered by what had happened to me. You know, and I wasn't the only one in that situation. They treat a lot of the other prisoners the same way they treat death row prisoners, and then they're just released back into society, but they didn't have the support systems I had. You know, they didn't have people standing by them waiting to help them readjust and get used to the world again. They just throw them back out on the street and say, there you go, figure out how to do it as you go along. You know, keep in mind, when I got out of prison, I hadn't seen a computer since 1986, and that was basically a glorified typewriter for rich people. You know, it wasn't connected to the internet or any of that sort of stuff. I had never used a cell phone. I had never used a debit card. I lived in a box for 20 years, so I couldn't even find my way to a doctor's appointment when I needed one. You have people every single day being released from prison just like that, so it's no wonder the recidivism rate is so high.
Did you have some serious street cred inside prison because you were a member of the West Memphis 3? Like, did people kind of revere you, or were you... Like, I know the guards beat the snot out of you, but what were the inmates like to you?
Death Row is a strange place. It's not like the rest of the prison just because everyone on death row has a common enemy. You know, when you're on death row, the state is trying to murder you. They're trying to put an end to your life. So it's like every person on death row, everything on death row involves fighting for your life in some way or another. You know, just for one example, we've had people ask me all the time, you know, you've had people like Eddie Vedder and Johnny Depp and Peter Jackson and Natalie Maines of the Dixie Chicks and Henry Rollins, you know, all these people come to your aid doing stuff for you. How did that feel when you were in there? And I would tell him, you know what, I would call home to my wife every morning, and she would tell me about these things. She would tell me what's happening. But when I hang up that phone, I'm going right back to just trying to survive another day in prison.
Yeah.
Those things to me were something that happened in another world, on another planet. And that's kind of the way everybody on death row functioned. It's like we're all in this together. The guilty ones, the innocent ones, we're all trying to keep from being murdered by the state. So people didn't really pay attention.
I want to talk about magic and the role that that has played in your life, because it was magic and meditation that got you through prison. That's true, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I need to know how that came. I mean, I know you were into it a little bit before you went into prison, and then I'm sure while you're there, you got access to some materials and you could talk to people. There's some notoriety, whatever else, and you kind of got into it more. But I want to know, again, logistically or realistically, how did you implement magic, M-A-G-I-K? First of all, let's talk about what it is, and then how did you actually incorporate that into your life so that you would not go insane?
Okay. Magic, when you hear magic spelled with a K, M-A-G-I-C-K, what that means, the reason the K is at the end of it, number one, it's to differentiate it from stage magic. You know, sleight of hand, pulling rabbits out of hat, sawing women in half. When you see it spelled with a K, what that means is it's like an amalgamation of Gnostic Christianity, esoteric Judaism, ancient Chinese Taoist energy circulation practices, all of these things. The particular branch of magic that I practice came through what was called the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, which was an order of magicians in the late 1800s. They started off in England. You had, you know, people like the poet W.B. Yeats was a member of the Golden Dawn. You had Pamela Coleman Smith, who was the artist who painted the paintings that we now think of when we think of the tarot. She was a member of the Golden Dawn. Aleister Crowley, one of the most notorious magicians of all time, he was a member of the Golden Dawn at one point. But what these people did, I mean, these were people whose intelligence was almost off the scale when you look at the actual work they did. They went into every single spiritual tradition in the world, and they did it with the quest. Their motto was the aim of religion, but the method of science. And what they wanted to do is look at the actual practices of all these different spiritual traditions, not the beliefs, not the dogma, not the rules, any of that sort of thing. They wanted the practices, and they wanted to know what works, why it works, and how we can make it work better. So they took all of the spiritual traditions of the world, stripped away the dogma, stripped away the unnecessary stuff to get to the actual core principles. And that's what I was practicing when I was in prison. You know, for one of the reasons I had to practice it, and I got to the point where by the time I got out of prison in 2011, I was doing energy work and meditation for 7 hours a day. And the reason, a lot of it was because, you know, like you said, I was on death row. There's almost no medical care, no dental care. They're not going to spend a lot of time and energy taking care of someone that they plan on killing. So there were times when I was so sick, I was certain I was going to die. There were times when I was in horrendous pain, when my teeth were hurting me so bad. You know, at one point, the guards had beaten me so severely that I started to urinate blood. The only thing that I had to help me cope with the pain, stay grounded in the present moment, help me to transcend all of that and keep going, putting one foot in front of the other, was magic. So that was what I had to help me cope with the pain, the trauma, help me get through those sorts of things. I did combine it with other elements from more Eastern traditions. You know, for example, I had a Zen master come from Japan to the prison. And eventually, over the years, I received ordination in the Rinzai Zen tradition of Japanese Buddhism, which was the same tradition used to train the samurai in ancient Japan. Even so, I still didn't identify myself as a Buddhist. I always identified myself as a magician. That's how I always thought of myself. And the Buddhist practices just sort of augmented that, added to that. But it became the focal point of my life in there. It's what my entire day revolved around, and it's what helped me survive.
Yeah, I mean, at one point, you went from visualizing four, and we'll talk about this, angels, to over 200 angels. So let's talk about what you believe angels are.
I believe angels are, I think it's, you know, strangely enough, I think reality responds to us in the way we expect it to respond to us. For me, the reason that I view certain pockets of energy and certain outside intelligences as angels is because I grew up in a Western spiritual tradition. You know, the Catholic Church played a huge part of my childhood growing up. So I was always taught that angels are always around us, surrounding us. Well, in ceremonial magic, you're always interacting with energy. You learn through time that the world responds to us almost, not even almost, but as if it's sentient. There's a thinking behind things. It's almost hard to describe, an intelligence behind things. But when we interact with those things, they start interacting back with us. For me, you know, for a Buddhist, those things would be given another name. Or for a Hindu, they would be given a different name. But for me, I called them angels because that's what I was raised up believing. And a huge part of training in magic in the very beginning stages revolves around an exercise called the Lesser Banishing Ritual of the Pentagram. Whenever you're doing this Lesser Banishing Ritual of the Pentagram, what you're in essence doing is sterilizing your environment. You're driving out all external energy, which for me in prison was very important because I was surrounded by the most vile, hateful, poisonous energy you can imagine. And I didn't want to absorb that. I didn't want it changing me. I didn't want it making me something else. So I had to find ways to protect myself from those things. And that's what the lesser banishing did. But when you're doing the lesser banishing, there's a segment of this exercise that involves invoking the four major archangels of the Western tradition, you know, the Archangel Michael, the Archangel Gabriel, the Archangel Uriel, and the Archangel Raphael. So I started off with just those four, and I worked with those four every single day, repeatedly, over and over. But then something happened, and I started to learn more and more about different intelligences, different kinds of energy, and in the West, we've given them different angelic names since medieval times. You know, medieval magicians did the same thing. So I started to interact with these other intelligences in the same way. And it reached a point where, you know, think of how hard it is just to sit in meditation and envision nothing but a candle flame. Envision only the way a candle looks when it's flickering, when the light's dancing. And it's hard to do. You know, you're going to find your mind drifting constantly. But then you reach a day, you reach a point when you can do it for an hour at a time. Well, then go from there and try to imagine four candle flames burning all simultaneously without your mind ever drifting off. And then multiply that again to see 200 candle flames all burning simultaneously without. And it's the same way with working with the angels. You know, I always say spiritual practice is like lifting weights. Either, you know, you constantly have to push yourself, grow stronger. And that's what magic does. It forces you to develop your spiritual muscle. There's nothing dark about it, nothing scary about it. You know, that's one of my quests right now in my life, is to reintroduce magic to people in a way that's not threatening, that's not scary, that shows that this is a valid Western spiritual tradition that is just as beautiful and just as useful as any tradition that you can find in the East.
You know,
that's a very long-winded answer.
No, this is good, dude. I'm engrossed. Okay, so here's the thing. You hear a lot of prisoners, especially, you know, death row, they find Jesus. They have a come-to-Jesus moment. They find Jesus. Some, maybe it's legit, some not. Nobody really knows except the person themselves. Even them, yeah, they could be kidding themselves. But one of the reasons they find Jesus is because of the forgiveness thing, is because of the grace thing of receiving forgiveness or forgiving, being able to let go of certain things, right? Let go and let God and all that kind of stuff, right? So, you didn't find Jesus. You went, you know, some would say a different way. But what I want to know specifically is, how have you processed forgiveness? Because, you know, as outsiders, all we can say is, if this is true that you legit had nothing to do with this, and for all intents and purposes, certainly looks like it's true that you had nothing to do with these three murders, then, dude, you got screwed over royalty. Even to the point where the government says, we're going to set you free as long as you can say that you did it. If you say you did it, if you say you're guilty, we'll set you free. That's whack. I don't care who you are. So I would be, I don't know what I would do with my rage, with my anger. How would I process forgiveness and grace? Good night, grace. You know, that would be a word that would stick in my mouth. So that's why you hear a lot of inmates, you know, hunkering down into Jesus. What have you done with forgiveness and grace?
I guess, you know, for me, there was a point when I was incredibly angry. For probably the first 2 years that I was in prison, I would wake up every morning from the second my eyes opened, I was pissed off. You know, I was not a happy camper. And then I realized this is eating me alive. This is making my situation even worse than it already is. Because now not only am I going through this external hell, but I have this internal hell going on at the same time, this anger, this frustration. And I realized I've got to do something with this. I've got to figure out a way to deal with this, or it's going to eat me alive. It's going to make me miserable. It's going to turn me into the rest of the people I see all around me. And that was another reason that I had to focus so strongly on the practice of magic. You know, I'm not talking about belief, but I always tell people belief is pointless. You can believe anything. You can believe the color orange is actually green, and it doesn't matter. It's not going to make orange green. What matters is the actual practice, what you're actually doing. So I had to put those things into action. And I guess now a lot of it, you know, people ask me a lot of times, why are you not angry? Why are you not bitter? And I guess the reason what it all comes down to is I realized how short life is, how important it is. You know, 20 years of my life was taken just like that, just gone in the blink of an eye. 20 years gone. And my life is half over. I'm 40. If I live to be 80, my life is half over. So I guess for me what it comes down to, if I sat in a dark room brooding, thinking about the judge screwing me off, the prosecutor trying to murder me, the police accusing me of something that they knew I didn't have anything to do with, I would be a very angry person.
Sure.
But what I realized is, you know, how, not only how short life is, but that I want to experience it. You know, if it comes down to a choice between sitting around thinking about those things or going out and eating ice cream, I'm going to go out and eat ice cream. You know, I wake up every single day. My wife and I look at each other at least once a day, and we say to each other, we've got a really great life. You know, I'm sitting in my apartment in New York City with a kitten on my lap, drinking a nice hot coffee, looking out my window at the snow falling, wearing comfortable pajamas. That's pretty damn good as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, hold on. Hold on. Hold on. You're wearing pajamas and holding a cat?
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, there's something wrong here.
Come on. That does not line up with all the tattoos you have, man. I'm just saying. Okay? okay. So, sorry, go ahead. I lost it there.
I was just going to say, you know, just for the people who can't see, I am pretty much covered in tattoos, everything from my jawline down. And that's also a huge part. I incorporate my own spiritual practices into those tattoos. You know, each and every one of them, it's not done to be pretty decorations. For me, it's all done. It's basically talismans, forms of prayer that can never be taken away from me. You know, I was in a situation where everything they could possibly take from me, they took from me. They even shaved my head. They took everything from me except my skin. My skin is the one thing they can't take from me. So that was what I used. You know, tattooing was a way of taking the things that are near and dear to me and making them part of my physical world in a way that no one can ever strip away from me again.
Damien, man, you and I could rattle on for a long time. It's like we've gone over time, and this is good. This is so good. Okay, how do you feel about Christianity, the church? Because growing up where you grew up, that's why you spent that long in prison. That's why you were convicted of murdering, you and your buddies murdering 3 8-year-old boys, because of Christians, because of Christianity, because of the church. And I end those with sort of the inflection of questions, because do you think that's true? You were convicted of murder because of Christians, Christianity, and the church.
You know, I think I looked at it that way for a long time, and it made me angry and bitter towards those people, almost having an axe to grind in a way. But when I look at it now in hindsight, I think of it as more along the lines as being not necessarily so much Christianity as just ignorance. You know, I always say I've got no problem with Jesus. I think Jesus was one of the, if not the greatest magician who ever walked the face of the earth.
I love you just made about 60 people listening wet themselves. So that's fantastic. That's so fun.
But it was a rough thing to come to terms with. It really was, because for a long time I did look at it that way. And now I still see a certain sect of Christianity. You know, I'll hear, you know, for example, if I'm turning through the TV channels and I hear a guy on TV preaching, you know, a lot of people won't believe this, but there's one minister named Joel Osteen. I listen to this man every single day.
That's so cool. Do you know how much Joel Osteen's PR team would want to hear what you just said? Don't ever say that out loud again, man, because you will end up with the same kind of teeth he has, all right?
But there are other ministers that I'll hear, and it's like it just turns my stomach.
Yeah.
I think those right there, that's the same kind of person who tried to murder me and would do it again.
Yep. Yep. Well, look, on behalf of somebody who was part of that tribe for 30 plus years, And I told you already at the beginning, I just feel – anyway, I just want to – I don't know. It's kind of like people apologizing for the Holocaust. They had nothing to do with it. But I do feel – I do feel – by the way, never use the Holocaust as an example.
Ba-dum-bumps.
Yeah. I feel like I used your name to further the agenda of these whack jobs that manipulated an entire nation, indeed, back in those days. And many of them are still going today. So I want to say, if Jesus is legit and real and the red letters and the stuff he really said, man, that's got nothing to do with that other stuff. With yeah, anyway, I'm stumbling here because I just feel like a schmuck.
Well, you know what? I mean, at least you're taking steps now to remedy it, which is more than most of the people. You know, most of the people who did stuff like that, who were involved in the whole satanic panic thing, they just, you know, slunk off like cockroaches once it was all over and peeled back in the dark corners.
Yep.
It takes a lot of guts to actually come out and say something like that. So I respect that, and I thank you for that.
I hope the art show goes well. I want everyone to check him out on Facebook, Damien Echols, Damien Echols, and of course Damien is spelled with three sixes. Sorry, man. I'm an idiot. I really appreciate this time. I really do. And like I said, I was less interested in the whole case and the movies and the prison stuff. I'm fascinated with your belief system. And if you guys come to Toronto, you got a place to stay, you can ride some horses, you can come on the radio show, co-host the thing, whatever you need to do. Okay, man?
That would be fun. Excellent.
You take care.
See you later.
All right, bye. Bye.
She said, you can only love what you die.